Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. business card and the Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at issuesetc.org, click Issues Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11 inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. Issuesetc.org, go to the support page, click Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
All indicators of American religiosity are either stable or declining, but the decline is slow, and Americans remain very religious by world standards.
I don't know how much God has to do to get the attention of the politicians. We've had an earthquake, we've had a hurricane. He said, are you going to start listening to me here? Listen to the American people.
With relatively few exceptions, the mass media tend to cover these disputed issues with a combination of ignorance, laziness, and bias against traditional Christian beliefs.
Every word of law, every damning exclamation is given to you for a purpose, to damn you to death, to kill you, to crucify you, and drive you to Jesus.
Southern Illinois truck drivers who love Issues, etc.
It's perhaps a counterintuitive for people who take their theology, their Bible, seriously, to realize that there is some common ground, not within the church, but in the realm of the civil world, the civic world. There is some common ground with people with whom Christians have very stark differences theologically. And if we share a common view of natural law, that there is a law that cannot be denied, that there is a right and a wrong that stands behind all other laws, an objective right and wrong, then that common ground is a place where we can actually cooperate on certain issues. So, for instance, you can find Christians who oppose abortion, and you can find Jews who oppose abortion, and they can work together in this public square to oppose abortion. What about Christians and Mormons? Do we share a common view or a close enough view of natural law? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Wednesday afternoon, the 31st of August. Dr. Frank Beckwith will join us to talk about Mormonism and natural law in the first half hour. In the second half hour, we'll discuss barrenness. Pastor Michael Schuerman and his wife Katie will be our guest. Michael is assistant pastor of Our Redeemer Lutheran Church in Dallas, Texas, and Katie is author of the new book, He Remembers the Barren. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1 hour, please, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address for your questions and your comments, talkback at issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, at issuesetc. Dr. Frank Beckwith is a regular guest, professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, author of the book Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, and he's also written a recent article for The Catholic Thing titled Mormonism and Natural Law. Dr. Beckwith, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
You conclude your article saying, Mormons and traditional Christians differ in many ways, but the attempt to pick a fight between them over belief in a natural law is not one of them. What do you mean?
Well, there have been some folks critical of Mormonism in terms of the presidential candidates that are out there, and they've said things like, you know, the difference between, say, Mormons and traditional Christians is that traditional Christians have always relied on a kind of natural law understanding to help them navigate the public square, whereas Mormonism is a sort of hierarchical authoritarian religion, and there is nothing outside of the authority of the church leaders. And when I first read that a couple of years ago in the magazine The New Republic, it struck me as odd because I know a little bit about Mormonism. I've published 4 books on Mormonism, and I know something about the Mormon scriptures and what the church teaches. And so I wrote this piece with that in mind in response to that accusation. And what is stunning is that how much in Mormon literature, in fact, does affirm a natural law. Now, having said that, though, I mean, clearly, one could, as I'm sure you agree, you know, that Mormonism is mistaken in many ways, but that doesn't mean that the LDS can't get some things right. And I think this is one of those cases. And I think historically the reason for that is that Mormonism comes out of 19th century American Christianity, which is in many ways committed to sort of the American founding's view of natural rights and so forth. And you have it in Mormon literature.
So give us a brief lay definition of natural law, classically stated.
Natural law is the belief that one can have awareness of a moral law without divine revelation. So for many of your listeners who have read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, those first five chapters are essentially a natural law argument for not only that there's a moral law that we can know without divine revelation, but that in fact, once we realize there is such a moral law, we have to ask ourselves, is there a moral lawgiver that moral law requires? Example I use in class, in fact, I just used it this morning. I'm teaching an undergraduate course here on faith, reason, and Christian belief, and I told my students that, gave examples from works of Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, who are atheists, and I told them, I said, you know, if you read their works, they oftentimes will bring up bad things done by Christians. Now, and those are some of those things we can agree are bad. But in order to make the judgment that Christians in the past did bad things, they would never, Hitchens or Dawkins or any of the other atheists, would ever accept the counterargument that, well, that was just their time and place. In other words, they would reject relativism as a way out of this. And in a way, as Christians, we can, I think, applaud and say, yes, you're right, there is a natural moral law by which we can judge others throughout history, regardless of time, place, or culture. And so it seems as though there is a natural moral law that even atheists can know, and they rely on it all the time. Now, of course, as I said, that's different from the question, how do we ground that moral law? And I think it seems to me that you know, in that case, the C.S. Lewis's argument really comes into play here, that you really can't have a moral law without a moral lawgiver.
So in the canons of Mormonism, that is, within the writings that are authoritative for Mormons today, do we find a teaching of natural law that is close to or similar to that of Christianity?
Yeah, you don't have anything explicit like, let's say, the Apostle Paul in Romans saying the law is written on our hearts or anything like that. But what you do have are a couple of interesting aspects to the Mormon worldview that I think support that idea. Mormonism relies on the understanding that the universe is sort of teeming with principles and rules that have sort of always existed. Now, you know, I have to here qualify it. Yeah, I don't believe that that's actually possible unless there's a divine mind behind it. However, the Mormons don't care. They say that the universe has always existed and that these principles are there. Well, these principles also include moral principles. And in fact, for that reason, in the Doctrine and Covenants, which is one of the LDS scriptures, it actually states that the U.S. Constitution is a divinely inspired document. And part of it is because of the belief that the Constitution, you know, allows for and supports fundamental rights. So, which is even, it's interesting, there's, you know, no American Christian that I know who even, you know, defends the American founding as deeply influenced by Christianity would ever say the Constitution is inspired, in a theological sense of inspired. And yet the Mormons say that. So, you find that, and then you find, you know, even within, Mormon writers, claims about justice and fairness and treating others with kindness that seem to appeal to a natural moral law. So it seems to me that it's, you know, it's all over the place in Mormon literature, but you have to look at it closely and carefully.
How would you respond to someone who says, look, it may well be that Mormons are kind of borrowing off of their Christian roots in order to maintain a view of natural law, but to contemplate cooperating with them in the public square when is what kind of lending credence to some very strange ideas that they hold otherwise?
Yeah, I've heard something. You know, I've heard a couple of critics mention that. Some folks have actually said they wouldn't vote for a Mormon because this would give Mormonism a, you know, sort of a cultural leg up. And my response to that, I'm not sure, first, if that prediction would be accurate. I mean, think about it this way. George W. Bush was a Methodist, and I don't think it, you know, his presidency boosted Methodism anyway. In addition to that, it also assumes that people come to believe things for kind of superficial reasons, like, well, who's the most popular guy in the White House? Or I don't think that's the way people come to believe things. In fact, if that were the case, with the popularity of President Obama when he was first elected, there wasn't a mass exodus from traditional denominations to the United Church of Christ, which is what he belonged to. So, I mean, it seems to me that that's not. I don't think the facts on the ground demonstrate it. On the other hand, though, you know, let's look at the kind of, well, that's kind of silly what they believe. I mean, that. Yeah, from the perspective of traditional Christians, that does seem to be the case. But, you know, someone could describe, for example, Orthodox Judaism by saying, you know, isn't it strange that they mutilate their children after their male children after 8 days by circumcision? You know, you can always frame or present a different view in a way that's not charitable.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. Another 10 minutes with him on the other side of the break, talking about Mormonism and natural law. It's Wednesday afternoon, August the 31st. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Whether you are just starting or have played your entire life, Oak Brook Golf Club in Edwardsville is your home for golf. Our 27-hole layout, fair prices, and award-winning staff, and ever-improving course conditions make your decision easy. We have always been family-owned at Oak Brook, and golf is our business. Our PGA staff offers leagues, instruction, camps, a senior scramble, and our family special where kids play free. Oak Brook Golf Club, 618-656-5600 or oakbrookgc.com.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. business card and the Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at issuesetc.org, click Issues Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11 inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. Issuesetc.org. Go to the support page, click Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Mormonism and natural law. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. He's professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and author of the book Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. You can purchase Politics for Christians under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. So, I'm trying to summarize here. What we have is the Mormon teaching that believes that there are eternal principles that even bind the deity, and we have to use that term with some care when we talk about Mormon theology and their view of gods, not just
right.
God, but gods. And in a sense, Mormon view of natural law is even kind of more transcendent than God himself.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, for the Mormon or for the Mormon worldview, God is a creature in the universe, and so he's not the, you know, to use a theological term, he's not the ground of being. He's just a being one of many beings in the universe. And so, you know, obviously and I mentioned this in the piece on Mormonism and natural law that you mentioned earlier in the broadcast. I say that one could, of course, raise, and I've done so. I published a chapter several years ago in the book I edited, The New Mormon Challenge, critical of the whole idea that one can have a natural law without a natural lawgiver. But having said that, though, a Mormon candidate who, let's say, embraces natural law, even though we may think that there are deep problems with it ultimately in terms of where it comes from, that doesn't mean the person can't believe it and live consistently with it and, in fact, you know, shape the public square in light of it. It would be very similar to, let's say, looking at someone like Thomas Jefferson, who was a deist, who denied, you know, the fundamental canons of Christian belief, and yet, you know, he said many things that we Christians can applaud. And it's the same sort of thing. One could be critical of how somebody, let's say, came to acquire a belief, but that doesn't mean that the belief itself is mistaken.
What about the particular concern that, at least for the mainline LDS church, there is a living prophet, and someone will worry, similar to concerns that one might have had about Roman Catholics in the public square in generations past with regard to the papacy, that with a living prophet on hand, a president, a senator, a Supreme Court justice has got somebody who's already got his ear and claims to speak for God?
That's a legitimate question. It's one that I think the LDS themselves have to provide a more solid answer. Let me give you the answer. If I were Mormon, I would give. And that Mormonism, because it's connected to a body of literature, a set of scriptures, as well as some of the claims made by prior prophets, is really constrained in how much change can go on. Now, the counterexample to this, which is, I think, a perfectly legitimate one to bring up, and that is the changing of the view about the priesthood within Mormonism. That is, one could be a Mormon, could not be a Mormon priest and be of African descent, be black until 1978, and change does come across as a kind of capricious act of just sheer authority. And I do think I think it's a legitimate question. I do think though on the moral issues, ironically, I think Mormonism is more constrained on those issues than the sort of technical ecclesiastical issues. But, you know, that as I, you know, I'm not a Mormon and I, you know, I wouldn't know how to defend it outside of that. But I do think it's a legitimate concern. And for that reason, I do think, you know, our Mormon friends have to develop a sort of theological way of accounting for this. But I don't have that fear that they're going to sort of become pro-abortion and pro-gay marriage tomorrow. I don't think you're going to have that sort of shift.
What we have the best example of in public life is probably Roman Catholic politicians who have publicly departed from their church's teaching, especially with those things bearing upon natural law, life issues, and the like. They've promoted abortion or something like that. And concerned Christian voters have felt free, even if they're not Roman Catholic, to hold those politicians accountable to their church's teachings publicly. That's not what your church upholds with regard to natural law. Should Christian voters be able to hold Mormon lawmakers or even perhaps a president accountable to the teachings of his own church?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if, let's say, you know, we were to elect somebody who is Mormon and who departs from the church's teaching, especially in those moral issues, I think other believers, you know, obviously non-Mormon believers, can raise that question. I mean, one of the great ironies, especially with the Catholic evangelical issue, if you go back to 1960 when Kennedy was running, you know, most evangelical Protestants were worried that Kennedy would listen to the Pope. And then in 2004, we had another Catholic running for president, John Kerry, and you had Protestant evangelical Protestants concerned that he wouldn't listen to the Pope. So, yeah, you sort of have interesting, and largely because the issues have changed. And so you find this sort of interesting phenomenon where you have, you know, evangelicals, you know, concerned that Catholic politicians live consistently with what their church teaches, which would have been, you know, a very odd thing to hear 50 or 60 years ago.
Now, let's talk a bit about the common ground in the public square. Christians have, for a long time, found it's now within their comfort zone. Mm-hmm. In my tradition, we would talk about cooperating in externals, not ecumenical relations, but in fact, cooperating in the public square on things where we agree in regard to natural law. What, with regard to Christians and Mormons, what is the shape of that common ground? How would you define its boundaries or its limits?
Well, I think that between traditional Christians and Mormons, I think the difference is going to be obviously a wider gap on, you know, as we philosophers refer to as metaphysical issues. That is, you know, some of the things we spoke about earlier about, you know, is the good grounded in God? That is the moral law based on God? And obviously on a variety of other issues about the nature of Christ, the nature of the church, and the scope of Scripture. But, you know, those sorts of disagreements we have to a certain extent with our Jewish neighbors as well. So you've got similar type of gap there. The difference is, of course, we think of Judaism as, you know, the ordained and correct and God guided predecessor to Christianity, whereas we think of Mormonism as a sect that has gone awry. So it's a little bit different relationship, but I do think in terms of what we hold in common, I really do think it's on an issue basis rather than a deeper sort of theological basis. So the similarities between, let's say, evangelicals and Catholics are going to be more theological as well as obviously political and moral, but you're going to have less of it, I think, theologically with the LDS.
Should we be concerned about something you mentioned early in our conversation, and that is, at least in writing, in the Doctrine and Covenants, the U.S. Constitution is regarded by Joseph Smith as divinely inspired. Now, if a politician or a lawmaker or a president believes in the divine inspiration of the Constitution, that is of a different category than believing in its kind of utility and its goodness. After all, we can amend the thing if we can get enough states to do it.
Well, you know, you could if you wanted to in that, if in a way, because of given the changes in Mormon doctrine, you'd say, well, of course the Constitution is divinely inspired. It can be amended just like Mormon theology, right?
I mean, well, I guess that's true.
I mean, so there's a sort of irony there. But, I mean, one could say, if I were a Mormon, I would say, well, that actually is the genius of the Constitution. It can be amended in such a way to take into consideration sort of changes in society. Yeah, I mean, the structure itself, I mean, it's interesting. Joseph Smith says this long before the Civil War. It'd be interesting, just sort of speculation here, would such things have been said prior to that? But yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think it's not true that the U.S. Constitution is divinely inspired, but if somebody were to believe that, I mean, that wouldn't change my, you know, alter my vote or anything. I think it's an unusual belief and one I don't think is justified, but In a weird way, one could say that someone like Romney or Huntsman, the two Mormons running, could actually use it to their advantage. They can say, because I believe it's divinely inspired, I am clearly not going to go out of my way to violate it. So,
Dr. Frank Beckwith is professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, author of the book Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, and he's also written a recent article for The Catholic Thing titled Mormonism and Natural Law. You can read this article at our website, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen on Demand page. Dr. Beckwith, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Todd.
When we come back on this Wednesday afternoon, we're going to turn to a subject that is, well, painful, and not just painful temporarily, but for some married couples, it is kind of a permanent pain. There's a lot of reminders around a young couple, especially early in marriage, if they cannot have children, that they cannot have children. Everyone around is, and they aren't. Not that they're not trying, but they're not able to. So how do we regard barrenness from a biblical perspective? And what is the comfort for a husband and a wife who, because of barrenness, cannot be a father or a mother? We'll answer that question with Pastor Michael Schuerman and his wife, Katie. Katie is the author of He Remembers the Barren, right after this. If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Treadmill for the mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Should we support a truce?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
With the rise of the Tea Party, some political leaders are seeking to focus attention solely on economic matters. In fact, a Republican state governor recently called for a truce on social issues until America's economic problems are solved. We in the pro-life movement, however, are glad that some are challenging this way of thinking. For instance, Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, responded that values such as the sanctity of life are important during good and bad economic times. Likewise, former Senator Rick Santorum said a truce on abortion would only cede ground to the pro-abortion side.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.